And this is Ms. G. I'm back here with a story by Mr. Patrick McManus out of his book, Never Sniff a Gift Fish. And the title of this first story is The Cat and the Cat Burglar. The sound of a vase crashing to the floor in the living room snapped my wife and me both upright in bed. "It's the cat," Bun hissed. "You forgot to put the cat out again." "Oh, go back to sleep," I said. "It's probably only another burglar." "You're trying to make excuses. I know it's the cat. You forgot to put it out." "Well, I'll prove it's a burglar," I growled, crawling out of bed and switching on the hall light. As I expected, a dark figure was wandering about the living room. "Hey, you." The burglar pointed a questioning finger at his chest. "Yes, you," I snapped. "You see anybody else in the living room?" "Now, come here. I want to prove to my wife you're only a burglar and not the dang cat. Besides, there's no point in eyeing the TV. It blew a tube in California during the Miss America pageant, which made two of us, hey." The burglar shuffled down the hall, a can of Blackjack Mugger spray trained on me. "Don't try no funny stuff." "It was only a little joke." "I know, but it was pretty bad, and I'm not up to it. I've had a hard night." "How come your house is so empty?" "We've had a lot of burglaries," I explained. "For a while, they were so frequent, we thought about asking the burglars to each take a number so there wouldn't be so many here at one time." "What did I say about the funny stuff?" "Sorry." "Say, I'd appreciate it if you would poke your head in the bedroom there so my wife will know you're only a burglar and not the cat." The burglar peered cautiously around the door and looked at my wife. "Oh, thank goodness, you really are only a burglar," Bun said. "That cat makes such a terrible mess when it gets left in. My nice rug in the living room." "Can it, lady," the burglar ordered. "I ain't got no time to hear about no cat messes." "Have it your way," Bun said. "But I really should tell you about Felix. He sometimes..." "I said, can it." "Well, if you're going to be rude, I'll just go back to sleep. The last few burglars we had were at least civil." "Sheesh, do I ever pick 'em," the burglar moaned. Then he turned to me. "Say, you're the outdoor writer, ain't you?" "Well, sort of," I replied. "Yeah, that's what I was told. All you outdoor writers got big gun collections. Let's have a look at yours." "My gun collection?" For years I had worried that some burglar would discover my secret gun room and clean it out. Now, under the threat of bodily harm, I was being forced to reveal my hoard of priceless firearms. "Oh, all right, follow me," I told the burglar. I led the way to the den, pressed a hidden button, and a wall panel slid silently back, revealing the secret gun room. The burglar whistled his approval at this bit of architectural ingenuity. "And there's my fabulous collection," I said, pointing to the gun cabinet. "Yes." "That's it?" the burglar gasped, awestruck. "Yes," I said, "that's it. A fence will pay you handsomely for these fine guns. Your fortune is made, I'm afraid." Unlocking the doors to the gun cabinet, I decided to take one last desperate chance to save my collection. "Why don't you sit down and make yourself comfortable," I said to the burglar, "and I'll tell you about these guns, should you decide to keep them for your own enjoyment. Knowing their histories will increase the pleasure of owning them." Apparently approving of this suggestion, the burglar flopped into an armchair while I removed one of my favorite rifles from the gun cabinet. "If you were a connoisseur of fine guns," I began, "I would first tie a bib around your neck so you wouldn't drool all over your clothes when I showed you this little 30-30. Notice, if you will, the grip of the stock." "Yeah. What caused that? Termites? Or did your dog chew it?" "To the contrary," I replied, "this is custom checking on the grip. Which, in all modesty, I must admit, I accomplished myself with a ball-peen hammer and a fine penny nail. True, the exquisiteness of the pattern is detracted from somewhat by the wrappings of baling wire and electrician's tape on the stock. You may also have noticed that the barrel is slightly bent to the left and downward, but I can assure you it's not more than an inch out of alignment. I won't go into how the stock got splintered and the barrel bent, except to say that it saved me from a nasty fall. The gun is still remarkably accurate, however, provided you make the necessary adjustments in your aim. I assume you have studied calculus? No? Well, perhaps one of those pocket calculators would work just as well. although a bit bothersome on a running shot. Feigning disgust, the burglar motioned for me to return the 30-30 to the rack. He pointed to another rifle. What's that? The 30-06? Close, I said. Actually, it's a 30-02, one of the predecessors of the 30-06. There was a little problem with the locking mechanism on the bolt, and the model was discontinued when it was discovered that the breech velocity sometimes exceeded the muzzle velocity. Otherwise, it's perfectly safe, as long as you don't forget to jerk your head away the instant you squeeze the trigger. My grandfather once killed a trophy elk with the bolt when the animal tried to slip past him 40 yards to the rear. But that kind of shooting takes considerable practice, and I don't recommend it for beginners. A hint of gloom had settled upon the burglar's features as he gestured irritably for me to return the 30-02 to the cabinet. I next took down a wonderful old side-by-side 12-gauge shotgun I also had inherited from my grandfather, old One-Ear, they called him, on my 14th birthday. As I told the burglar, the shotgun had one interesting little eccentricity, which was that on about every third shot, both barrels discharged simultaneously, regardless of which trigger was put or squeezed. Since I weighed only 125 pounds at the time, most student pilots log less flight time than I did on an average hunt, and their landings are a good deal softer. As for the effects of these double-barreled kicks on my anatomy, the high school football coach once observed me coming out of the showers and leaped to the conclusion that I had contracted a progressive disease in which one shoulder takes on the general shape and color of a Hubbard squash. There was also the problem that my nose from week to week seemed to drift about my face, sometimes anchoring under my left eye and at other times setting a course for the center of my forehead. This feature was nicely complemented by my right ear, which appeared to have been run through a pasta-shaping machine. I used this fine old gun for nearly 20 years, I told the burglar, but people were always asking me about the accident, and I got tired of telling them I had saved my commanding officer in Korea by throwing myself on a hand grenade. The burglar stifled a yawn with his fist. Come on, guy, I ain't got all night. You know, let's beat it up on these histories, huh? Right, I said. I think you'll like this next one. I unracked the single-shot 22 rifle that had been given to me by my parents when I was 11 years old. Ah, never was a gun given more tender care than that one. I cleaned and oiled it three times a day, whether it had been fired or not, and never allowed a speck of dust to settle on it for more than a minute. So how come it's all rusted and pitted? The burglar asked, his voice fairly reeking with exasperation, perhaps because I was delaying my account of the 22 in an unsuccessful attempt to wrench the bolt back. As I told the burglar, a couple of months after the 22 had come into my possession, I was out in the back pasture, target practicing on a tin can, when who should show up but a neighbor by the name of Olga Bone Marrow. I didn't much care for girls at the time, and considered Olga in particular a great nuisance. Ignoring her, I continued to plink away at the can while she directed a torrent of prattle at the back of my head. Suddenly, a single question leaped from the torrent like a sparkling cutthroat from the spring runoff. "Do you want to come over to my house and play doctor?" Olga had asked. By sheer coincidence, Olga had hit upon one of my great enthusiasms of the moment, namely the field of medicine. Such was my passion for the art and science of curing the sick that target practice and even my beloved 22 were immediately blotted from my conscientiousness. Attempting to comport myself in a dignified manner, appropriate to a serious student of medicine, I raced panting after Olga to her house, where we slipped upstairs to her bedroom without detection by Mr. and Mrs. Bone Marrow. While I grabbed a window curtain and dried my palms, which were sweating profusely from the previous exertion, Olga rummaged around under her bed, finally extracting a large flat box. The box for a moment consumed 100% of my attention, for on its lid was printed the word doctor. Olga took off the lid, removed a board zigzagged with lines of squares, placed two tiny white wooden figures on the square bearing the title Med School, and then began to shuffle little stacks of cards. Even as I sized up the situation, my interest in the field of medicine began to fall off sharply.
I just remembered a previous engagement. I told Olga and headed for the door. "Hold it, Buster," Olga snapped, adding with ominous vagueness, "or I'll tell Pa." Pa, I should point out, was built like a nail keg and had a temper shorter than a gnat's hiccup. No matter what Olga might tell him, I deduced it wouldn't be good. And it was easy to imagine a hairy nail keg drop-kicking me through a second-story window. Still, I was not the sort of person to be intimidated by childish threats, and I immediately demonstrated to an astonished Olga. In fact, in only my first three throws of the dice, I got out of med school, interned in a major hospital, and was making big bucks performing cardiovascular surgery. Not only was the game boring, but it lasted slightly longer than the last Ice Age. By the time it ended, my mental faculties felt as if they had been stir-fried in molasses. I staggered off home and dropped immediately into bed. The next morning, I awoke with a jolt, realizing that somewhere in the fiasco with Olga, I had mislaid my rifle. I left the house so fast the screen door twanged for a week, but the .22 was not to be found. It was as if it had slipped from my sweaty palms the day before and disappeared down a gopher hole. My grief was monumental and has lingered even into the present day, causing me still to hold the entire medical profession in general distrust and responsible for the loss of my .22. The following spring, I found the rifle on a stack of fence posts where it had wintered over. As a boy, I often read many articles that warned of the ills of failing to clean and oil a gun after each use, but never did I read an article warning against leaving a gun on a stack of fence posts all winter. You would think some shooting editor might have mentioned that at least once. "So that's how my .22 got rusted and pitted," I told the burglar, who seemed on the verge of suffering an infarction of some sort. Now, moving right along, this rather peculiar-looking rifle here is actually a .270. I restocked it myself with the arm from an old rocking chair, and the burglar held up a hand for me to seize. "Listen, pal," he said, "maybe I'll just take the TV after all. You can keep the guns." Clearly, the man had been touched by my show of affection for the guns, which was what I had hoped for. Out of appreciation for his change of heart, I led him back to the living room, loaded him up with the TV, and even tried to warn him when he started out the wrong door. When the ruckus in the yard finally died down, I went back to bed. "Is the burglar finished?" my wife asked sleepily. "I'm afraid so," I said. "If the poor devil had had enough sense to drop the TV, he probably could have made it over the back fence before Felix got him. You know, having an attack cat isn't such a bad idea. But if these burglaries ever let up, we're going to have to start buying cat food for him." You've been listening to me read Patrick McManus's The Cat and the Cat Burglar from his book Never Sniff a Gift Fish. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska, and I will be right back. Stay tuned. Everyone, hello, this is Ms. G again, and I am bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And I have another Patrick McManus story, The Man Who Notices Things. Fenton Quagmire had this irritating habit. He notices things. Even when we were kids, Fenton noticed things. One fourth grader teacher, Mrs. Terwilliger, was keen on noticing things herself. All right, class, she'd say, who noticed anything different about our room today? Pat? There's a picture of George Washington on the wall, I'd try hopefully. That picture has been there ever since they built the school. Now, Eugene, do you notice anything different about the room? Nope. Lester? Uh-uh. One by one, Mrs. Terwilliger will call out the names of the boys in the class and ask if they noticed anything different about the room. They would reply with negative grunts, wild guesses, and looks of total befuddlement. She never called on any of the girls, of course, since it is well known that girls notice things. Finally, the teacher would get to Quagmire, who would have been waving his hand in the air and snapping his fingers for attention. All right now, Fenton, I want you to tell these dunces what's different about the room today. Quagmire would then point out some piddling details, such as that the wall to the cloakroom had been removed, or all the seats were facing in a different direction, or Mrs. Twilliger was dressed up like Woody Woodpecker. We dunces would emerge from our lethargy long enough to express our amazement that we had failed to notice the thing, whatever it was, and would whisper vows among ourselves to make life miserable for Quagmire at the next recess. The casual observer might suppose that the rest of us boys enjoy tormenting Quagmire, and we were frequently hauled into the principal's office to face such charges. The truth was, it was Quagmire who tormented the rest of us. I remember, for example, a championship softball game in which we were ahead by one run in the ninth inning and the opposing team with two outs had the bases loaded. An easy fly ball was batted out to Quagmire in center field. The ball bounced alongside him and disappeared into a weed patch. He was on his hands and knees staring at the ground. Cries of rage and anguish went up from the rest of our team. "Hey, guys," Quagmire shouted, "guess what I just noticed out here? A four-leaf clover." In his peculiar innocence, he assumed that the reason his teammates were converging on him so rapidly was to satisfy a lifelong curiosity about four-leaf clovers. I saw that it was up to me to save him. In the musical chairs of childhood relationships, Quagmire was from time to time my best friend, and this was one of those times. The code back then required that you do whatever you could do to save your best friend, so I immediately took defensive action on his behalf. "Run, Quagmire, run," I shouted. "But first, grab that four-leaf clover, because you're going to need all the luck you can get." Sometimes I wasn't able to save Quagmire from the violence he called down upon himself. Once he and I went fishing together on the opening day of trout season. I was still in the grip of first cast of the season jitters as we waded through some tall grass on the way to our favorite fishing hole. Suddenly, Quagmire pointed at my feet and shouted, "Look out!" In response, I raised both knees up alongside my ears, then did some aerial gymnastics that would shamed a Nadia Comaneci. "What?" I yelled, still treading air. "What is it?" "Why didn't you notice these little globs of foam on the grass?" said Quagmire. "You nearly stepped on them. See, they look like spit, but there's a little bug inside each glob. I'll bet these little bugs make spit houses for themselves. If you'll notice right here is a glug arf arf arf." Bug spit houses. It was just lucky for Quagmire that my hands were too weak at age 10 to effectively strangle a person. Nevertheless, it was some years before he again noticed anything in close proximity to my feet. My friend and mentor, the old woodsman, Rancid Crabtree, could not abide Quagmire. Once when Fenton and I were in high school, I suggested to Rancid that we take him hunting with us. "No, no, no," yelled Rancid. "He ain't going hunting with us, and that's final. I can't stand the way that boy is always noticing stuff. What ain't even worth being noticed?" "Oh, come on, Rancid," I urged. "Fenton doesn't have anybody else to hunt with." "Wow, shoot. Maybe this one time. But you tell him we're going hunting and not just out noticing things. You got it?" "Right." I had a little talk with Quagmire, and he promised he would try not to notice anything on our hunting trip. He did try, too. I'm sure of that. Driving up into the mountains on our hunt, Quagmire could scarcely contain himself. He would glance out the window and then swivel his head around. "Say, did you?" he'd start to say. I'd elbow him in the ribs and he'd shut up. "What's that?" Rancid would say, glaring. Quagmire's eyes would be wild with excitement over what he had just noticed. "Nothing," he'd say. Then Quagmire started studying the dashboard on Rancid's old truck as we bounced along. "Pardon me for mentioning this, Mr. Crabtree, but I know..." I jabbed my elbow into his ribs. But, he sputtered. I shook my head at him. From then on, the drive was peaceful, and if Quagmire noticed anything else, he had the good sense not to mention it. A couple of hours later, we were trying to catch up with a herd of mule deer we had jumped earlier. Quagmire was making a sweep around the mountain above us, while Rancid and I, having about given up hope of ever catching sight of the mule deer again, rested at the foot of a high cliff. Rancid was stoking his lip with tobacco when Quagmire appeared at the top of the cliff, frantically signaling to us. "Gol dang," whispered Rancid, "the boy seen the herd. I always said he weren't a bad feather. I guess the only thing we can do is climb the cliff." "Gee," I whispered back, "it's awfully steep. I don't think we can climb clear to the top." "Sure we can," Rancid hissed. Halfway up the cliff, Rancid spat his tobacco out into space. "I got some bad news for you," he said to me. "What's that?" I asked. "I don't think we can make it all the way to the top," he grunted, his clawed fingers digging into a vertical slab of granite. "But that ain't the bad news." "Well," I asked, "what's the bad news?" "I don't think we can climb back down, neither." I considered Rancid's assessment of our predicament much too optimistic. Fortunately, at that moment, I discovered an inch wedge ledge that angled right up under the overhang that was covered with wet moss. "This way, Rancid," I said. "I see a way out." And sure enough, scraped, battered, and bruised, the two of us soon scrambled over the lip of the cliff. "Dang," Rancid said, rubbing his knee as we looked around for Quagmire. "I sure wouldn't have worn my good pants if and I'd known we was going to climb that cliff today." "Tear 'em, did you?" "No." "Now, where in tarnation is that Quagmire?" Presently, we saw him crouch behind some bush, signaling to us. Unslinging our rifles, we hustled over in a walking crouch, being careful not to make any sound that would spook the deer. "Where is thy Fenton?" Rancid whispered, peering over the top of the bush. "This is fantastic," Quagmire said. "Look at these rocks here. I was just walking along when I noticed them. See how round they are? Why, they're river rocks. What are river rocks doing this far up on the side of a mountain? Do you know what this means?" "Yep," growled Rancid. "It means, Quagmire, that when you pick up one of them rocks, there better be a herd of deer under it." The river rocks weren't even the worst part of our day. When we got back to Rancid's truck, it wouldn't start. "That's what I tried to tell you, Mr. Crabtree," Quagmire said. "I noticed on the way up here that your gas gauge was on empty." Rancid leaned his head on the steering wheel. I didn't know whether he was crying or just counting to 10. Middle age hasn't diminished Quagmire's obsession with noticing things. His hair is gray now, his face eroded by time and weather, but still the bright little eyes relentlessly ferret out things to notice. I dread having Quagmire come in the house when he picks me up to go fishing. "I notice you got a new hairdo," he says to my wife. "Looks nice." "Why, thank you," Bun said, adding, "I'm glad somebody noticed." "My gosh, you did get a new hairdo," I explain. "When did you change from the bouffant?" 1965. "Oh." Meanwhile, Quagmire has found something else to notice. "What happened to your other goldfish?" he asked. "It died last summer," Bun said. "When did we get a goldfish?" I inquire. "I see you painted your living room blue," says Quagmire. "You did?" I said to Bun. "Heck, I like the brown." "The brown was four colors ago," snarls Bun. And so it goes. Needless to say, Quagmire is very popular with women who seem to have a certain irrational regard for men who have a compulsion to notice trifling details. "Why can't you be more like Fenton?" Bun wails at me. "You never notice anything." "Well, that's certainly not true," as I informed Bun in no uncertain terms. "It's that I'm selective about what I notice. I don't just go around noticing indiscriminately, for Pete's sake." I recently spent 3 days hiking alone through the Cabinet Range of the Rocky Mountains, and Bun would have been amazed at all the things I noticed. I noticed that the trails were a good deal steeper this year than last. There was no doubt the result of some foolishness on the part of the U.S. Forest Service. When I got back home, I fired off a letter to the USFS
and told them to leave the trails alone. They're steep enough. I noticed the nights are darker when you're alone in the mountains than when you have company. Scientists should investigate this phenomenon. It might be something the CIA can make use of. I noticed after a couple of hours staring out into the abnormal darkness that there was a hard, knobby object under my insulite pad. No doubt a seed dropped by a careless ant. I noticed a mosquito and marveled that a creature so small could be so enormously complex, and still could find nothing better to do with himself than walking around in my ear singing a light opera. I noticed an ant crawling up my leg, probably the same careless chap who had dropped the walnut that was under my insulite pad. I noticed far off down in the valley the sound of a large clawed foot pressing into moss. I noticed I didn't have a gun with me and wondered if there was a tool on my Swiss Army knife with which to fend off a grizzly. Maybe the corkscrew. I imagined the headline in the newspaper, "Grizzly Corkscrewed by Lone Hiker." I noticed that the ant had been joined by some friends and relatives. They were probably helping him look for his baseball. I noticed the distant whistle of a train and wished I was in the lounge car exchanging dry jokes and drier martinis with traveling salesmen. I noticed that it was only a cold, slimy sleeping bag drawstring slithering across my neck, but not until I had killed it with a blow from my hiking boot. Should have waited until it was off my neck, though. I noticed that the sound of the large clawed foot was right next to me, and the beast was making an assault on my jerky bag. One usually doesn't find chipmunks with such large clawed feet. It was a cheeky fellow, though. The sight of a man feinting wildly at him with a Swiss Army knife corkscrew scarcely fazed him. I did enough noticing on that outing to give me my fill of it, and I haven't noticed anything since. A dog could ride past me on a unicycle smoking a cigar and doing an impression of Groucho Marx and I wouldn't notice. The first person I ran into on my return from the mountains was Quagmire. "That must have been quite a trip," he said. "I noticed that you've lost 15 pounds. "Ha! Quagmire isn't as perceptive as he likes to think. I hadn't lost an ounce over 10 pounds. You've been listening to me read The Man Who Notices Things by Patrick F. McManus from his book, Never Sniff a Gift Fish. This has been Left Hanging with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Until next time, good night.